From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a feminist who was raised in a harem, we talk with Moroccan writer Fatima Mernissi about what it was like to be part of the first generation of young girls allowed to leave the harem to attend school. Now she's a professor and author of a feminist analysis of Islam. Also today, comic Carol Leifer. She writes for Seinfeld. Jerry Seinfeld is her good friend and former boyfriend. Remind you of a character on the show? And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Steven Spielberg's new film about the Holocaust, Schindler's List. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Defense Secretary Les Aspin resigned today, saying he's leaving for quite personal reasons.
I have been working continually for over 20 years to help build a strong American military. It's time for me to take a break and to undertake a new kind of work. So I've asked the President to relieve me of this duty as Secretary of Defense as of January 20th. I know that while Bill Clinton is our commander-in-chief, our country will continue to grow in all of its strengths, our men and women in uniform will always be honored, and we will be true to our best values as a people.
Aspin's brief tenure at the Pentagon has been marked by ill health and controversy. He underwent open-heart surgery shortly after taking the job. Aspin also came under criticism for his refusal to reinforce American troops in Somalia. In Geneva, the most far-reaching trade agreement in history has been approved by 117 countries. NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
With the bang of a gavel and the cheers of a standing ovation ringing in his ears, GATT Director General Peter Sutherland brought an end to the Uruguay round of the GATT. He called the agreement a defining moment in modern economic and political history that would bind people together by trade at a time of increased world tension. The new agreement is a comprehensive set of rules and obligations covering virtually every area of world trade. Under the GATT, tariffs around the world will drop by an average of 33%. The agreement is expected to add $250 billion annually to the world economy by the year 2000. I'm Michael Goldfarb in Geneva.
In Haiti, outgoing Prime Minister Robert Malval has canceled plans to hold a national reconciliation conference, which had been seen by many analysts as a final effort to restore democracy. NPR's Sunni Khalid reports.
Haiti's canceled National Reconciliation Conference was scheduled to take place tomorrow in the capital, Port-au-Prince. It was to have brought together the country's social and political figures to discuss how to implement the Governor's Island Agreement to restore democracy to Haiti. Haitian Prime Minister Robert Malval, however, cited a number of obstacles which forced him to cancel the conference, including his failure to win expected support. Malval, who officially tendered his resignation today, had hoped that the conference would revive efforts to end Haiti's political crisis. The cancellation of the reconciliation conference may have killed off the Governor's Island Agreement, signed last July between Haiti's military ruler, Lieutenant General Raoul Cedras, and exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Cedras reneged on the accord 2 months ago, just before Aristide's scheduled return to Haiti. I'm Sunni Khalid in Washington.
Stock prices closed lower today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials lost 25 points to close at 3,717. Declines led advances. This is NPR. The prime ministers of Britain and Ireland said today that they've reached agreement on a plan for negotiating peace in Northern Ireland. John Major and Albert Reynolds said they'd support any agreement that was acceptable to a majority of Northern Ireland's people. In an unprecedented show of defiance to Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic, rebel Serbs in Croatia have voted overwhelmingly for a man ousted by Milosevic 2 years ago. Croatia says the elections held in the Krajina region were illegal and undermined peace talks. Richard Carruthers has just returned from Krajina and files this report.
These were the first elections on the third of Croatia still under Serb control. Krajina Serbs voted overwhelmingly for a dentist, Milan Babic, who led the rebellion against independence from Yugoslavia back in 1991. Babic was toppled by Milosevic for refusing to agree to the UN peace plan that ended 6 months of war. Now it is sweet revenge for Babic that he's defeated a candidate who controlled the police and was backed by Milosevic. People apparently feared Milosevic may sell out Krajina back to Croatia to consolidate other Serb conquests and get sanctions lifted. Babic, though, has a reputation as an extreme nationalist who wants to enlarge Krajina, reach the coastline, and cut Croatia in two. That would certainly provoke another bloody Serbo-Croat war. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
An Alabama towboat pilot testified today that he believed he was approaching another vessel when he struck the bridge that caused a deadly Amtrak train derailment. The pilot, Willie Odom, told federal safety investigators that he was lost in the fog on the morning of September 22nd and that the radar signal from the bridge looked to him like another vessel. Barges that Odom was towing struck the bridge, knocking the track out of line and causing Amtrak's Sunset Limited train to plunge into a bayou, killing 47 people. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest grew up in a harem, but she's now one of Morocco's best-known feminists. Fatima Mernissi is the author of The Veil and the Male Elite, a feminist interpretation of women's rights in Islam. Her forthcoming book, Dreams of Trespass, is a memoir about growing up in a harem. The harem was the part of a Muslim house that women were secluded in. Her family shared a compound with her aunt, uncle, cousins, and grandmother. Upstairs in more modest quarters lived her divorced and widowed women relatives and their children. Mernissi was born in 1941 in Morocco and grew up in the first generation of girls who were allowed to go to school. Her mother was only allowed out of the harem for special occasions and religious festivals. I asked Mernissi if her mother felt like a prisoner in the harem.
Well, she hated it, of course. She hated it. Mostly because already the Arab world then was completely entranced with the idea of progress and the nationalist songs, you know, about freedom and self-fulfillment and all that. She would hear it on Radio Cairo. And Cairo and the Ottoman, Turkey, was then the center of an incredibly powerful feminist movement. And they will hear the songs, they will see the movies with all these feminist stars, in a way. Believe it or not, the feminists were stars. And they were on the press and on the, just like movie stars here now today. And so she could just compare how sad was her confinement.
Did your mother try to not wear a veil when she went out?
She fought in the limits which were granted to her. What she did was, instead of wearing the hayek, for example, which is this 7 meters long piece of white cloth, she wanted to take man's jellaba, which is the long robe with trimmed sleeves, which give much more freedom to the movements. And that was a huge battle because it was like when the French women or the American women took the liberty to wear men's pants. It was the same thing.
So what was your father's attitude?
Oh, of course he opposed it. It was a big battle, but she won. And that was one thing. The other thing was the little piece she used to put around her face. We call it litham. Now they say veil, but it is. I am talking about the little piece you put around your face to cover your mouth and nose. And that little piece, which was supposed to be very opaque and not transparent, my mother fought to get it to change it into a very transparent chiffon, silk chiffon little piece she put on her nose. And that was a big scandal until it became just a normal fashion the wives of the nationalists brought to town. And then in the meanwhile, while she was fighting for that, the daughters of the nationalists started going out in Western dresses.
Did you always support your mother in these battles? Did you have an opinion?
Support her? She would support me. I mean, she was such a strong feminist advocate. I wouldn't say she support. I think she pushed all of us so fast that we couldn't but be strong feminists in a way.
Did you ever have to wear the veil or that long cloth you were describing yourself?
No, because in the 40s that was already finished. That was already the past, or in the villages, like, let's say, the women would be backward men who would be veiling their daughters. But the sophisticated men of the cities were already into something else, you know, into getting the education for their daughters, wanting them to speak foreign languages.
So there was a different standard when you were growing up between what you were supposed to do and your mother. Your mother still had to wear a veil, but you weren't expected to?
Absolutely. You see, between the two generations, actually, one woman, a historian, told me, a Moroccan historian, that in Morocco, 10 years of difference between women, in women's age, like, let's say, two sisters who have 10 years of difference, they would be belonging to different centuries. You know, the age does not have the same impact. My mother was living, let's practically in the medieval time, and I was already in 20th century. So the generation between mother and daughter was an incredible progress for women. And there is actually, one cannot understand what's happening to women in the Middle East if they don't realize that the mothers are strong, progressive force. The mothers push the daughters to get out of the harem, to get the education, to achieve what they could not even dream of. The result is now, with only one or two generations of women who have, actually only in the 60s did millions of Arab women get access to education, massive education, state-paid education. Now we are one-third of the university professors in many Arab countries are women.
You studied in the West in college. You studied at the Sorbonne in Paris. You studied at Brandeis University in the United States. A lot of people who come to the West to study stay there. You returned to Morocco in spite of all the limitations on women's freedom there. You continue to live in Morocco. What has kept you there?
Oh, my God. I think if you know Morocco, you'll understand my situation. Morocco is such a beautiful place. It's incredibly beautiful. And also, it is a captivating place because for a writer, you feel that you make impact. I mean, when I write something in the press, the day after, in the fish market, people would be discussing either they're attacking me or they like what I've written. And then two men will get into a fight with each other. One is for me and the other against me. So you are umbilically linked and rooted in this society which has its own, of course, worries and fears about modernity.
You've written several books basically giving a feminist interpretation of women's rights in Islam and to challenge certain beliefs that people have, the beliefs that Islam is an inherently sexist religion and culture. You've gone back to the text and you say that's not so. So I take it you've remained a Muslim even though you've challenged a lot of people's beliefs about Islam.
Absolutely, and you see, one of the frontiers I crossed is actually the act of analyzing the memoir and the religious text and the historical text and how history is made and framed and produced and packaged. And I just, by looking and doing that, I mean, reading history for myself, I discovered, first of all, that the Prophet is a wonderful person and any Muslim woman could claim it as an inspiring model. And this is on one hand. And on the other hand, that I showed that the real boundary was, and the real mistake of women was to let the memoir, the collective, the history, space of producing history, to let it in the hands of men. And I started this slogan, I, as a Muslim woman, living in 1993, I want to have two things, the mosque and the satellite, both at the same time. And no one can mutilate me by telling me I cannot have the mosque or the Quran. Someone else is going to read for me or to go at my place. To the mosque, and or to tell me you shouldn't take anything from the West because the West is the enemy and so on. It is to me to decide. I am intelligent enough to be critical towards the West and take what I need and reject what is bad for me.
So you want to find a way to maintain your religion and Islamic culture, but also live in the modern world, have equal rights with men, live with 20th century technology if you choose to use it, that you don't think the two should be contradictory?
On the contrary, the more satellite, you see, the more satellites there is in the skies, the more televisions sending us all kind of messages from the West, the more we need our memoir. So You need your traditional, your civilizational background just to situate yourself and remember who you are in front of this mediatic invasion by consumerist messages of all kinds.
My guest is Fatima Mernissi. She's a well-known Moroccan writer and feminist. Her books include The Veil and the Male Elite, a feminist interpretation of women's rights in Islam. And she has a forthcoming memoir called Dreams of Trespass, Tales of a Harem Girlhood. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Moroccan writer and feminist Fatima Mernissi is my guest. What kind of reaction has your father and mother? I should say I don't know if they're still alive.
My mother is still alive. My father died when I was young.
What kind of reaction has your mother had to the work that you've done and the things that you've written? You described her before as a very strong woman and as a woman who rebelled against a lot of the restrictive customs.
She doesn't think I have done enough, because what she would like me to do is to have a political career. She is mad with Moroccan women because we did not invade the parliament and we are not making the laws and we don't have a television. She told me, what kind of power do you have with the books instead of getting yourself enough money to buy a television? And I I just think that she is completely okay, and I was thinking about why I didn't do this. Yeah, because that's why power is, in fact.
Has she been able to take advantage of the new opportunities open to women since the period of your childhood when your father enforced a very restrictive life?
Well, she remarried after my father died. And what she loved most was traveling to other parts of Morocco. Also, she went to Spain and discovered that Spanish didn't speak Arabic. So discovering the world and the other culture is indeed something she is fascinated with. However, she didn't make the effort to become literate, or she just told me she has too much stuff on her mind to concentrate on learning how to write and read. And she didn't try to learn foreign languages.
What was it like for her to start going out on her own after so many years of her adulthood in which she wasn't allowed beyond the door?
She loved it, of course. She loved it. More of this one thing she couldn't do, for example, she, like I am from Fez, which is this 9th century old city with a lot of crafts. And one of the things women do, and I still do myself, is you make your own clothes. You don't buy them all made. So that you choose a piece of silk or the color you like, then you keep it for a while and you think about what kind of passementry and embroidery you want to put on it. Then you discuss that with the man who does the passementry or the woman who does the embroidery, or you do it yourself. Well, she couldn't go out to choose the cloth or the silk, the color of the silk, because, you know, I don't know if you have been in a store where there is this silk colors. It's just wonderful shades and stuff. She could never do it. And one of the pleasures of her post-harem life was to go for hours to choose and match the colors of the kaftans she creates. When you have been in a harem, it was too late for her to do, to do business, for example. She would have liked it. But she needed to get more information, and it was too late to get into that kind of radical change of your life.
Do you think your mother was typical in being such a strong woman and in being such a rebellious woman?
Absolutely. The women, one of my big findings, for example, looking at my life and that of my mother, is the traditional women did not make the compromises the modern women are making, because they didn't have much to lose. But me, I have a lot to lose. So like in a department meeting at the university, I try to be sleek in a way. I mean, not to avoid confrontation. And I know I have to get, let's say that I want to organize something at 6 o'clock, and I have to persuade the two teachers that they have to change their own schedule. So I make compromises. I try to be really cute. My mother would never do that.
You have a forthcoming novel about growing up in a harem. And I've been able to read a couple of advanced chapters from that memoir, which I enjoyed. And along with those chapters, I have the table of contents for the forthcoming book. One of the chapters is called Mustaches and Breasts. What is this chapter about?
It's about me becoming, turning... nine, I think. Nine, yes. Getting to be nine and learning what happens, you know, to your body when you are about to become
pubescent.
And that was taught to us in school, because that's part of our Muslim education, to teach us about the body transformations, because you have to have knowledge, you know, scientific knowledge. And then when I came back to school, from school, to my mother and told her that I know that my little cousin is going to be very soon having a very strong voice and mustache, and that I would have breast, and she was completely taken back and shocked that I was given this information and that I was no more a child. So the book is about that empowerment of the little kids when they get cosmic information about bodies and about how children are made and all that thing.
I have one last question. You're visiting the United States on a short trip. Are you comfortable as a woman in Western culture, or do you feel Western culture goes too far with certain things?
You see, Morocco is a very strange place. You know that Morocco, in the summer, you have maybe 3 million of Moroccans on the beach, swimming, men and women, with bikinis and stuff. So for me, the West is not that far. And of course, we will swim during the day, and then during the night, I wear my kaftan. Of course, what the problem with being in America, for example, for me is the speed. Mm-hmm. I am completely exhausted by 3 o'clock. I cannot put my ideas together because there is everything is going too fast, and I'm not used to being bombarded with so much information. I usually have 2 hours a day on meditating, and it's often in the morning. Since I am here, I don't have, not only those 2 hours are taken by a lot of stuff I have to do, but I don't have a minute to sit and see what I'm doing, where I'm heading. You know, just like coming to the taxi to this meeting with you, I was trying to see if I could get 5 minutes just to concentrate, because for me that's absolutely necessary. And I couldn't do it because I was too dispersed, looking left and right to the new buildings and all that stuff. And then finally I just said, okay, I just have to do it like the Americans do, which is they don't stop to reflect. and I'll see what will happen.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Merci.
Fatima Mernissi teaches sociology at the University of Mohammed V in Morocco. She's the author of The Veil and the Male Elite, a feminist interpretation of women's rights in Islam. Her forthcoming memoir about growing up in a harem is called Dreams of Trespass. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, some blue humor and a Seinfeld script in progress. We talk with comic Carol Leifer. She writes for The Seinfeld Show, and she's up for several awards for her own cable special, Gaudy, Bawdy, and Blue, in which she paid tribute to the comedians of the 60s who specialized in risque humor. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Schindler's List, Steven Spielberg's new film set during the Holocaust. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In a surprise announcement from the Oval Office late this afternoon, President Clinton said that Secretary of Defense Les Aspin is stepping down effective January 20th. Aspin cited personal reasons, saying it was time to take a break and undertake a new kind of work. Aspin is the first member of the Clinton cabinet to leave and does so after a year of a number of difficult choices, including disagreements with Budget Director Leon Panetta, changes in the military, and U.S. involvement in Somalia and Bosnia. In addition, the 55-year-old former congressman had a heart pacemaker implanted last winter. Officials of the Clinton administration continued to stress positive aspects of Russia's recent election, noting approval of a new constitution. As for the surprisingly strong showing by an extreme nationalist, President Clinton said it is important not to overreact. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
President Clinton suggested Russians voted for Vladimir Zhirinovsky not to endorse his specific views, but to protest the free fall of the economy. Acknowledging the hardships Russians have experienced, he said the administration must find ways to help Russian citizens. But he continued to support his economic package with all its austerity measures. Some would argue while Russians may not have rejected reform per se in these elections, they have said no to the kind of tough measures supported by Washington. Nonetheless, top administration officials hope that when the votes are finally counted, Russian President Yeltsin will be able to continue with his reforms. President Clinton said, "Because I don't know there will be any change in Russian policy, I don't see any basis for a change in our policy at this time." But he added, "It's something we'll have to watch and work with." I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
A study in this week's New England Journal of Medicine provides new information on the health benefits of drinking moderate amounts of alcohol. David Barron of member station WBUR in Boston reports.
It's widely accepted that having a drink or two each day can be good for your heart. Now researchers at Harvard Medical School think they know why. Dr. Michael Gaziano has found that moderate drinkers face about half the risk of heart attack compared with people who abstain. The reason appears to be that alcohol boosts levels of the good form of cholesterol, called HDL, in the bloodstream.
HDL cholesterol is responsible for taking the fat and cholesterol from our artery walls back to the liver where it can be disposed of.
But Gaziano stresses that alcohol is beneficial only when consumed in moderate quantities. When people drink too much, he says, the good effects on cholesterol are outweighed by the harm caused to the liver and other organs. For National Public Radio, I'm David Barron in Boston.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down nearly 26 points to close at 3,716. This is NPR News. Nearly 1,000 French troops have left Somalia as part of a Western pullout from the nation. Meanwhile, U.S. officials say that U.N. aid efforts to Somalia will concentrate now on helping areas outside the capital that are willing to cooperate. Diplomats believe that a regional approach will help those areas more interested in rebuilding than in taking part in factional fighting. U.S. forces are slated to leave Somalia by March 31st. In Ireland, there's been conflicting reaction to a declaration for peace issued by the British and Irish prime ministers. From Dublin, Joe Little reports.
The political allies of the IRA have only begun considering the joint British-Irish declaration, but first indications are that the initiative may not be enough to persuade the IRA to down arms in the short term, at least. Mitchell McLaughlin, a leading member of Sinn Féin, which supports the IRA, said he was disappointed by what the two prime ministers had to say. He said Irish nationalists felt let down. But Sinn Féin and the IRA have yet to issue a formal response. The declaration promises the Irish people the right to self-determination, but it guarantees the Protestant majority inside British-ruled Northern Ireland the right to remain with Britain. The leader of Northern Ireland's largest pro-British party did not condemn the Prime Minister's initiative, calling it a tortuously worded document containing many contradictions. For National Public Radio, this is Joe Little in Dublin.
After 7 years of effort, diplomats from more than 100 nations have approved a world trade treaty. The agreement is to open up international markets and speed up economic growth by breaking down export barriers. The head of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade called it the most far-reaching trade agreement ever. The agreement will be signed in April and take effect in 1995. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. This season on The Seinfeld Show, the name of another popular comic has been added to the writing credits. Carol Leifer has been a friend of Jerry Seinfeld's since she started doing stand-up in the late 70s. A lot of people know her from her frequent appearances on The David Letterman Show. Now she's up for 2 Cable Ace Awards for her Showtime comedy special, Gaudy, Bawdy, and Blue. She wrote, starred in, and co-produced this mock documentary about a fictional comedian named Rusty Berman, who was popular in the 50s and early 60s for her risque humor. The program opens with Leifer as Rusty Berman at a nightclub in the 50s. Wearing a sequin dress, she's seated at the piano, doing her act.
Did you hear about the woman ironing her brassiere? Her husband says, "What the hell are you ironing that for? You got nothing to put in it." She says, "I iron your shorts, don't I?" Did you hear what Lord Godiva said to Lady Godiva? "Where the hell have you been, you rat bastard? Your horse got home 2 hours ago." She's the yellow rose of Texas. She charges $50, the richest girl in Texas, and all she does is those. Laugh loud, or I'll sing clean songs.
Who are some of the comics you're paying tribute to in this mock documentary?
Probably mostly it was based on a woman named Rusty Warren, who was very popular in the 50s and early 60s. She had an album called Knockers Up that actually sold, I believe it's 8 million copies, Terry.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, and also women like Pearl Williams was another woman that was around then doing that kind of comedy. And other people have come up to me with other names of women that were around who did this style of cabaret comedy. And it really fascinated me, especially Rusty Warren, since she was so popular and yet so out of sync with the time in that it was a true underground kind of popularity.
So what made you think about these comics recently?
I guess mostly that, being a woman comedian and knowing what that's like in the current comedy scene, thinking about what it must have been like 30 years ago. You know, on Miami Beach in the late 50s, you know, Rusty Warren did a 4 a.m. show. I just really, I get such a kick out of that's what, you know, the nightlife was like then, that, you know, it's 3:30, got to run down to the show, you know, 4 a.m. And that, you know, they worried about being busted. And when Pearl Williams played Carnegie Hall, I believe either she got arrested or, you know, cops were in the background. It was a real dangerous element to comedy. It was, you know, real Lenny Bruce-like kind of comedy.
Did you write the jokes for Gaudy, Bawdy, and Blue, or did you get some of them from the old records?
Well, actually, my dad is, you know, king of the joke tellers. Mm-hmm. And
I thought my dad was king of the joke tellers.
Well, actually, our little piece of Long Island, I have to say, my dad laid claim. But, he's the type of guy who's, give me any subject, throw out a subject, I got a joke for it. So he's semi-retired now, so I called him before I was going to do the special. I said, "Dad, get a tape recorder, put a tape in, and every dirty joke you know, put on a tape." So I really credit my dad with giving me a lot of the material, but, you know, a lot of the jokes are from those type of comedy albums. But even, you know, joke telling is a dying art form. You know, the two guys walk into a bar and that kind of thing. And so I like that part of it, too. That, you know, part of comedy intrigues me, too. And it's sad to me that it's really kind of dying out.
Would you tell the one about the guy who has 6 hours to live?
Oh, yeah, that's actually one of my favorite jokes of all time. So a guy comes home from the doctor. Wife says, "What did the doctor say?" And the guy says, "Doctor says I have 6 hours to live." So wife says, "What would you like to do?" He says, "How about sex?" So they have some sex. She says, "All right, what would you like to do now?" He says, "How about some more sex?" She says, "Okay." They do it again. A little while later, she says, "All right, what would you like to do now?" He says, "How about sex one more time?" She says, "Look, I got to get up in the morning." But you know, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. I'll be here all week.
Now, can you tell this kind of joke in your own performances?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think if you go to the improv, you know, you're expecting, Shecky. You know, I mean, if you go to, I went to the Concord Hotel with my family last year. And yeah, that's where, you know, you see these kind of guys who get up and do that kind of comedy. But, you know, it's dying. It's really kind of gone. It's really, even, you know, in the special as Rusty Berman, when she's being interviewed, you know, she says, the kids today with the, did you ever notice this and you ever notice that? No, I never noticed. You know, tell me a joke. You know, I've heard that from older comedians over the years. You know, I think this kind of style of comedy that's prevalent now kind of baffles them. Because to them, you know, comedy is, two guys walk into a bar and that, you know, that's what a show is.
My guest is comic Carol Leifer. Her Showtime comedy special was called Gaudy Bawdy and Blue. She's now a writer on The Seinfeld Show. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with comic Carol Leifer. Now, you work with The Seinfeld Show. You're a writer on the show, sometimes listed, I believe, as a consultant?
Yeah, I was originally a program consultant, and now I'm a story editor. And they're all titles that are just mean writer.
Writer at different salaries, maybe?
Right. Different food chain salary levels.
Now, you and Seinfeld used to actually be a couple, right?
Yes, we dated briefly.
When was that?
1977, it's got to be.
So does this make you Elaine?
No, actually, people would think that probably since Jerry and I went out. But no, actually, the character of Kramer is based on me. Well, Jerry and I dated, and then since then we've been great, great friends. So I think that people would kind of maybe think that, but, you know, Julia has really, really made Elaine her own. But I guess that it's natural for people to think that since we're friends who used to go out.
Have there been any storylines that did come out of your experiences together?
No, I wouldn't say any specifically. No, but working there now, they really like real-life experiences and translating that to the show. You know, they really want to keep it on a real plane, so I try to think. And everybody who writes at the show, you know, now I find myself doing a lot of things that I maybe wouldn't do before because I always think, well, I could get a story idea out of it.
Like what? What have you done to get a story idea?
Well, semi-recently, a gay friend of mine asked me if I wanted to go with another gay friend of his to the Hollywood Bowl because the guy was going with, he works in banking, and he was going with his boss, and he kind of needed a beard. to go with him.
A beardette.
Yes. Beardess. So I went with him and actually got a storyline out of it. So I was happy that I could do that.
Has that one been on yet?
No. But it is funny because when you put yourself in these situations, it's much easier to think. You know, like I was thinking when I went to the Hollywood Bowl with this guy, you know, when he went to go to the bathroom, you know, it might have been funny if, you know, the boss and his wife then turned to me and say, you know, I hope you don't get your hopes up too high with this guy because, you know, he's gay. You know? And then when, you know, he comes back, you know, Elaine would be like, oh, you know, you don't know how wrong you are. We're practically living together, you know, and starts like making out with him. So, you know, I definitely do more things now that maybe I wouldn't necessarily, just to kind of see what happens.
Being the only woman on this staff of writers, as I believe you are you often in the position of having to give the female point of view and saying, nah, a woman wouldn't do that?
Well, besides getting coffee for the guys. Yeah, and actually, sometimes, even really very small ways, I was just working in my office once, and Jerry called me from downstairs and said, what's a really fancy type of woman's shoe? What's a nice shoe? You know, I said, oh, I don't know, like slingback pumps? Yeah, that sounds good. Okay, thanks, you know. So sometimes it's really in small ways like that. But, yeah, I think definitely, you know, being the woman there, they asked me about things that relate to women. But I really have to say, all the guys there are really, you know, there wasn't even a woman writing on the show last year. And I really think that they write for women very well. I don't think it's like a lot of other shows that I would watch where you're sitting at home and you're thinking, boy, this really doesn't sound like kind of things women would say or talk about. I really do think they have a good ear for what women talk about and think about. So I don't think I'm relied on all that heavily. I think they have a good beat on it.
Well, I wanted to ask you, you have dated Jerry Seinfeld, as we mentioned. You also used to date Paul Reiser, who now has his own network show. I figure like the network should give sitcoms to your boyfriends or something.
Right. If anybody wants to get a network spot, my number is 555.
So when did you date Paul Reiser?
Well, actually, Paul is the entire reason why I got into comedy. We both went to State University of New York at Binghamton. And so we started going out in college, and we both had a big interest in comedy. Actually, he was the first guy, when I met him at a party, who he was doing lines from The 2,000-Year-Old Man. And I, you know, I heard it like this mating call, you know, on the other side of the room. And then we started, you know, talking. I mean, he was the only guy that I ever knew my age who knew the album. So we started going out, and then he had told me during the summer when we were off from school that he would go to Catch Rising Star, this nightclub in New York that had audition night where anybody could go on. So I went and I watched him one summer, and he did great, and it looked like a lot of fun, so I started doing it. And then we both passed the audition at a place called the Comic Strip, and Paul was a year ahead of me at school, so he had already graduated and decided to pursue a career in comedy. And so I left school, actually, to start doing comedy. But I started at a very good time. When Paul and I passed the audition at the Comic Strip, Jerry was actually the MC at the audition night. So, you know, we started out together, and Dennis Wolfberg and Larry Miller, and you know, it was a really good time to start because it wasn't the boom that it is now. It was a purer, simpler, gentler time, Terry.
So did you leave Paul for Jerry?
I dated a lot of comedians in those days. I'm not exactly what my route of flight map was like then, but, you know, when you're around comedians and they're really the only people that you see, You know, during your evenings, you're bound to date a few of them.
Right. Now, I know you grew up in a family of doctors. What kinds of doctors were you surrounded by?
Well, my mom is a shrink. A lot of shrinks in the family. Mom is a shrink. My brother and my sister is a shrink. And my father is an eye doctor. So they can all see their problems really clearly.
What was it like having a mother who was a shrink? Did she...
Actually, I have a joke about it in my act. It's hard to picture my mom solving other people's problems when she's the root of most of mine.
Right, right.
But, yeah, it was, it's definitely, it's different. You know, I mean, I used to tell this story, too, in my act about how, you know, there are advantages to it. Like, I remember when I was... during driver's ed, you know, my mom took me out to drive one day and I accidentally, you know, hit a squirrel. And my mom was like, don't worry, you know, the squirrel clearly displayed suicidal tendencies. It's okay.
Do you ever sometimes hear your mother in your own voice or see her in your movements?
Oh, it's amazing. In the special, I mean, you know, dressed up kind of with the wig and the dresses, it was really kind of uncanny how much, you know, I look like my mom.
Did you use her voice? Because your voice,
no.
I think, is huskier in the special.
Definitely. As Rusty, I talked a lot more like this. And this is all my relatives in Boca. That's that voice. Honey, get me a Fresca.
What's the next episode you've written for Seinfeld?
The next episode I'm working on now, well, I have the two. I have the beardette mm-hmm. idea, and I'm working on a new one now that is actually inspired by something that happened in real life, too, with Jerry. We were going to the movies about a month ago, and a bird flew into my apartment, which totally freaked me out, and... So he came over my apartment, and I was so impressed, Terry. He just grabbed some oven mitts and got that bird out of there like Superman. So I was very impressed. So that's part of a new story now.
Carol Leifer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Hey, Terry.
Yeah?
A pleasure.
Carol Leifer is a writer on The Seinfeld Show. She's up for two Cable Ace Awards for her Showtime special, Gaudy Body and Blue. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
We'll be hearing about agreement on the GATT, also an announcement by the prime ministers of Britain and Ireland about some principles they've been able to agree to. We'll be hearing from Alex Chadwick today about sanctions and Haiti. Alex was down last week in Haiti, and he's described what impact economic sanctions have had on the island. It's devastated many people, he says. Also, we'll be hearing today about the Vatican's decision to develop full diplomatic relations with Israel, and a story about the Arkansas SNL scandal that some say involves President Clinton.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. At the box office, Steven Spielberg is the most successful movie maker ever. Taken together, his 15 films have grossed more than $4 billion. But so far, Spielberg hasn't had quite the same success with critics or with the Motion Picture Academy, which has never favored him with a Best Picture or Best Director Oscar. Will his new film, Schindler's List, change all that? Film critic Stephen Schiff went to investigate.
Oscar Schindler was a drinker, a philanderer, and a swindler. He was a cynical businessman who came to Krakow, Poland after the Nazi invasion, looking to get rich off the spoils of war. There was nothing in his past that could have convinced anyone that he had the makings of a hero, but that's what he turned out to be. And in telling his story, Steven Spielberg has undergone a similar trajectory. There's nothing in his previous work, thrilling though a lot of it has been, that could have prepared you for the greatness of Schindler's List, a film almost as astonishing and, yes, even heroic as its main character. Although the movie's based on a brilliant 1982 novel by Thomas Keneally, it's a true story. Schindler was a Nazi party member who arrived in Krakow at the very moment that the Jews were being rounded up and registered and siphoned off into the ghetto. As Jewish businesses were shut down and factories left idle, Schindler saw an opportunity. He would take over a now-defunct kitchenware factory and use it to make pots and pans for the army. All he needed was money, workers, and know-how, which led him to call on a Jewish accountant named Itzhak Stern, played here by Ben Kingsley.
You must have contacts in the Jewish business community working here.
What community? Jews can no longer own businesses. That's why this one's in receivership.
But they wouldn't own it. I'd own it. I'd pay them back in product, pots and pans.
Pots and pans?
Something they can use. Something they can feel in their hands. They can trade it on the black market, do whatever they want. Everybody's happy. If you want, you could run the company for me.
Let me understand. They'd put up all the money. I'd do all the work. What if you don't mind my asking, would you do?
I'd make sure it's known the company's in business. I'd see that it had a certain panache. That's what I'm good at. Not the work. The presentation.
That's Liam Neeson as Schindler, in a performance that combines a buccaneer's swagger with the glamour and mystery of a latter-day Gary Cooper. Neeson's portrayal is dazzling, and so is the way Spielberg and the screenwriter Steve Zaillian handle his character. They never tell us what it was that made Schindler take the risky course he took. They never give him a moment of blinding transformation or conversion. What happens in this movie is that, very gradually, a war profiteer becomes the man who saves 1,100 Jews from the Holocaust. And he does it not because the milk of kindness flows in his veins, but because he's merely human, merely decent. And because tricking the Nazi goons appeals to his sense of bravado a lot more than going along with them. The movie falters in its last 20 minutes, but up until then, it's all the more powerful for the coolness and lack of sentimentality Spielberg brings to his fearful subject. He knows he doesn't have to sell the horror. All he has to do is show it. And he does, with a clarity and a fury that are palpable in every frame. Spielberg has constructed his film as a gripping tension between two forces, between darkness and light, between the gathering darkness of the Holocaust and the gathering light of Schindler's redemption. The cinematography plays off that tension. It's in the most magnificent black and white, and when Schindler's list, the list of the Jews he's saving, is finally typed, the black ink against the white paper drives home a subtle point, that Schindler's goodness has actually arisen because of the evil that surrounds it. What Steven Spielberg has accomplished in 1993 is unprecedented in the history of the movies. In 1 year, he's made the biggest box office hit ever, Jurassic Park, and with Schindler's List, the finest film made by anybody, not only this year, but in many years.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer today was Naomi Person. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, and Thad Kirk. Devin Reif is our intern. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Landmines placed in time of war continue to maim and kill civilians long after the conflict is over. About 100 million landmines are in place now around the world. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Eric Stover, Executive Director of Physicians for Human Rights, about why his group is calling for a ban on these weapons. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.